This event is refreshingly different, obviously a lot more fun and a lot more thoughtful and pioneering, and no doubt that's because it's hosted by Warwick University, so I'm very grateful to them for inviting me to speak to you today. Now, when I started to think about what to say this morning, I thought about calling this talk, "Will Our Children Get Jobs?" And then I was told that was far too, that was not a good idea, leaving it hanging as a question, and that it would be much better to say something more affirmative. So the title of my talk this morning is No to Generation Jobless, and what does that mean for the future of education? And what I thought I'd do is cover sort of three topics. First, how the IMF sees the state of the world economy today, and I will mix metaphors and use two themes of a three-speed recovery and an arc of unemployment. Second, I'll say something about what can be done to achieve what's often called, what has become the mantra in every G8 communique, sustainable and balanced growth, and what can we do to achieve that. And third, I'll say something about what does this mean for education. What can we do so that the next generation is not jobless? And what does that mean for universities? So let me start with where we see the world economy today. Actually, if you look at financial markets, things are looking quite good. Financial markets have staged quite an impressive recovery in the last 6 months. And if you look at indicators like the S&P 500, the Emerging Market Index, they've actually returned to levels that we hadn't seen until the collapse of Lehman in 2008. So we had a big sharp downturn, and now things are looking up. I can tell things are better because I'm no longer getting emails from distinguished economists who I know, whose subject lines are, "The world will end on Monday," which I did get last year. But we at the IMF don't actually expect world economic growth to be much higher next year. Our projection for 2013 is that growth will be about 3.3% in the world and will go up to about 4% in 2014. But if you look underneath what's happening in financial markets, we see a much more complicated picture, what we are calling the three-speed recovery. It's unevenly distributed in different parts of the world. We have some parts of the world that are doing quite well, the emerging markets and the low-income countries, growing at well over 5% a year. We have a second part of the world, which is sort of on the mend, led by the United States. And we have a third part of the world, which really has some distance to go and is facing very low rates of economic growth, verging on stagnation, and that's Europe and Japan. And certainly in many parts of the world, there is no sense that the crisis is over. These improvements that we've seen recently in financial markets have not translated into improvements in the real economy and in the lives of real people. You know the numbers, 200 million people out of work, 73 million young people globally looking for a job. And when we look at what happened to employment levels since the crisis, they've come down incredibly sharply. In fact, the ILO estimates that the global labor force has shrunk by 29 million since the crisis began. Now, the places where this is felt most acutely is an area that The Economist magazine referred to as the arc of unemployment, which stretches from southern Europe, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Italy, across North Africa, through the Middle East, and to South Asia. In Spain, Greece, Portugal, 40 to 55% of young people are unemployed. In the Middle East, about 30% by 2018. And the most worrying things are those young people who have the unfortunate acronym of the NEETs, right? The neither in employment, education, or training. Those who've given up completely on being able to contribute economically. Now, we know that youth unemployment has dire consequences for the individuals involved, but also for the societies in which they live. We know that it implies increased cost to the economy, that it involves lower lifetime earnings, there's the risk of brain drain, lower life expectancy, and higher crime rates. Let me say something briefly about each of those. In terms of the cost to the economy, clearly human capital not used, but also higher fiscal costs. This graph is quite interesting because it shows how other various countries have coped with the rise in unemployment and what policies they've used to try and address it, ranging from direct job creation in the public sector, which is what countries like India and Saudi Arabia have done, to some extent Mexico, but also special measures to support small and medium enterprises, credit facilities, subsidies to employers to maintain existing jobs, which have been used in the UK, in Mexico, in the US, and so on. But this shows very clearly the very significant, running well into the billions of dollars, fiscal costs of the high unemployment rates that we are seeing now. We also know from much of economic work that episodes of high unemployment, particularly early in one's career, leaves a wage scar that lasts for often decades. This shows what happens to earning loss at the point of job separation, and you can see that 20 years later, those earning losses are still being felt by the individuals involved. Youth unemployment is also generating high levels of out-migration in countries like Ireland, Spain, and Portugal today. We've seen a sharp increase in young people, particularly leaving home because they have no prospects at home. And in the Middle East, the other part of the arc of unemployment, out-migration has been a feature of economic life for decades. We know that unemployment also reduces life expectancy. This shows what happens on the effect of job displacement on the probability of death, and you can see the years, you know, more or less after 5 years of job displacement, we see this sharp reduction in life expectancy. And we're seeing rising crime rates, even in advanced economies where violent crime has been on the decline for many, many years. In countries like Spain, Greece, and Portugal, we've seen an uptick in violent crime. So, what can be done? How can we achieve that balanced and sustainable growth that every G8 communique says is a global priority? At the IMF, we've done quite a lot of research recently on the relationship on what drives employment and unemployment. And that huge research effort keeps pointing to one major factor. Growth is most of the story. Other measures can help, but measures that promote growth doesn't completely solve the unemployment problem, but it gets you most of the way there. In fact, if we look, I won't go into too much detail in this graph, but this basically says what is actual unemployment on the y-axis, and the x-axis says how much of unemployment would you expect in a model based on what happened to growth in these countries. And the fact that most countries are along this line shows that most of the unemployment can pretty much be explained by what's happened to growth in these countries. So countries like Spain, who've had very low levels of growth and very high levels of unemployment, you can pretty much explain that poor unemployment by what's happened to growth in the Spanish economy. So what are the prospects for growth, particularly in those countries facing very high levels of unemployment? Well, the outlook is very mixed. The emerging markets, who are growing quite robustly, have very good prospects. We expect growth rates well over 5% for the next couple of years. For the advanced economies, we see a bifurcation between the United States, which is going to grow about 1.9% this year and probably as high as 3% in 2014. And in sharp contrast, if you look at the euro area, we expect the economy to shrink this year in Europe and grow by a modest 1.1% in 2014. So again, the three-speed recovery is going to result in a three-speed labor market and recovery of employment. Now, the IMF has been advising our 188 member countries to address three overarching issues to try and restore global growth. The first is completing the reform and regulation of the financial sector. Second is to rebalance global demand. And third, to have a greater emphasis on growth, jobs, and equity. But even if we assume that policymakers do all the right things to fix these economic problems, it will take years before growth will be enough to make significant inroads into unemployment. I'll just give you an illustration with Spain and Portugal. both of which are suffering from incredibly high rates of unemployment today. The blue line is our baseline growth projections for what we expect these economies to do, and on the x-axis it shows you what that growth will do for unemployment. The dotted red line shows an optimistic scenario for growth if these economies do much better than we're expecting. And you can see that the impact on unemployment is very modest. In a country like Spain, you would bring unemployment down from about 25, 26% to 22%, still unacceptably high. Now, policymakers can clearly deploy other more direct labor market policies to try and address job creation more directly. That includes things like education and training, hiring and wage subsidies, public works programs, childcare subsidies, and lower taxes on labor. But it will still take some years to make a dent in these very high unemployment rates. So governments need to really think out of the box and do things a bit differently. And that's where education policies come into play, which brings me to my third theme, which is, what is this fast-changing nature of the world of work mean for education, and how can education prepare people for this world economy? Let me start by saying a few words about the impact of technology, which I'm sure you discussed a great deal yesterday. It's clear that technology is changing the nature of work. The New York Times columnist Tom Friedman had an article recently where he said, you know, in the olden days, 85% was just showing up. You know, if you kind of got a decent education, you could pretty much guarantee that you'd get a decent job and lead a more or less middle-class standard of living. Now, he says, average is over. Jobs are constantly being re-engineered. Innovation has become an essential survival skill. I remember once talking to someone who was an education specialist, and he said, you know, traditional education was really designed to prepare children for the world of work. They were taught to sit at their desks, sit still, and do repetitive tasks all day long. And that was the old world of work. Well, that's clearly not the case anymore. And what we see emerging is really a three-tiered job market. We have, at the top, non-routine jobs that can't be outsourced. Senior managerial jobs, designers, highly skilled engineers, innovative scientists. That's at the top. At the second tier, we have the routine mid-level jobs that are easily outsourced. Support functions in banking or IT, call centers, those kind of routine service jobs. And the third are the non-routine local work that has to be performed face-to-face. Hairdressers, nail salons, those are jobs that are actually growing in number. The care industry, I think, as Lord Skidelsky called it. The US is a very good case in point. If you see what's happened to the US labor market, the fastest growth in jobs in the United States since the crisis has been in these low-skilled areas of food preparation, domestic services. The second fastest growing jobs have been at the top, at the high-end service sector. All those jobs in the middle have disappeared and have seen no growth, and in fact declining growth since the crisis. So new graduates are going to face this three-tiered job market and have to figure out where do they want to be. And new graduates will have to invent their jobs. The traditional lifetime employment, choose your career, doctor, lawyer, scientist, etc., will no longer be there. Those clearly well-defined career paths will not be what our children face. So is more education the answer? Across the OECD, people who left school early are more likely to be unemployed. So clearly education provides some protection in the current labor market. So education helps, but on the other hand, we all know examples in both the UK, in the United States, and across Europe in particular, of people with expensive liberal arts degrees who are finding it impossible to get decent jobs. And in North Africa and the Middle East, being a university graduate doubles the likelihood that you'll be unemployed. We recently held our annual meetings in Tokyo last autumn, and I was held an event with young people from across Asia. And these were the gilded youth of Asia, you know, the girl in China who got the highest math score in all of China. A young man from Japan who had the best university degree in all of Japan. These were the best and brightest of the fastest growing part of the world economy. And the number one issue they wanted to discuss was whether they'd get jobs. My mouth dropped open. You know, I thought, if these young people are worried about being employed, what can one say about our kids? At least those are not my kids. So the other issue, of course, is going to be cost. Are people going to be willing to pay in future $500,000 for a degree from Harvard and Stanford? Or will more young people opt for getting certificates from online universities for $500 at different stages in their life? Will the model of a 3 to 4 year university education, which is supposed to equip you for your entire career, feel outmoded? And will people opt instead for truly lifelong learning, where education is tailored to support people at different stages in their careers as their careers evolve in a dynamic fashion over a lifetime? I'm sure you've talked a lot about massive online open courses, and I know that the UK equivalent, FutureLearn, consortium of 21 universities, includes our host today, among many others. And there are many issues with MOOCs and online education, but I am sure that online education will be an increasing part of the educational landscape going forward, and the issues and the problems with it will be resolved in some way. Even the IMF, which is not normally at the forefront of radical new ideas, has joined the bandwagon and is moving some of the training that we provide to thousands of government officials around the world in economic management to an online platform. And this development will put high-quality education within the reach of millions of young people, including in developing and emerging markets. So it has huge potential to be an equalizer around the world. Of course, it won't substitute, but it will complement more traditional universities. But it will also have to change the way universities provide value added. Someone said to me recently, increasingly, it's not what you know, because Google knows everything. It's what you do with what you know which will determine success in life. Analytical skills, innovation, creativity, and ability to join the dots, those will be key for the high-quality jobs that we all aspire to. And that's where universities have a very special role to play. Of course, to be of benefit, these opportunities will be very different for students in developing countries. Young people in advanced economies are grappling with issues like the higher cost of education, but their counterparts in developing countries, especially in Africa, face much more basic challenges. We've seen huge progress in access to education in low-income and emerging markets. And on the quantitative side, educational enrollment has gone up from about 50% at the primary level to about 80%. So really massive, massive progress. But those countries have been far less successful at achieving improvements in the quality of education, which would then enable students to take advantage of all of the online opportunities. And here the numbers are much more grim. In a country like Mali, half the students at grade 3 couldn't recognize a single word, frequently used word, in their language, showing a real lack of basic reading skills. In Pakistan, grade 3, only half could answer very basic multiplication questions. And even in emerging markets like Colombia, Indonesia, Thailand, there's a huge gap at the secondary level in terms of basic math skills. So those children will enter the world of work without the knowledge and skills necessary to cope with this very different labor market and world economy. And for them, other types of interventions will be necessary. Let me close by just saying a word about the role of the IMF. There are many policy areas that are not in our mandate. We basically focus on macroeconomic and global economic issues. But in many of those areas where we lack expertise, we work very closely with other institutions, the ILO, the World Bank, the European Commission, and with universities. The main contribution we bring to this agenda is to create the economic conditions in which those jobs of the future will emerge, and to try and create a future in which is not jobless. One thing is clear, the world cannot afford to lose an entire generation, not just because of the pernicious economic consequences, but also because youth unemployment has a corrosive effect on society itself by disconnecting young people from the social and political institutions in their countries. So there's quite a lot at stake, both politically and economically. And we, of course, will do our part in terms of doing everything we can to restore global economic growth. But rethinking education is also a key part of the answer, and you, the educators, are part of that solution. Young people today don't just need more education. They need education relevant to a very different labour market and a world economy that's very different than one we've ever faced before. Thank you very much.